Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 72. This is Part 2 of our English origins of the Jamestown row houses. So we're going to talk about the design of the row houses in Part 2. Okay. So although the row continued to be viewed by many as an economical form of building, it also became associated as a means of promoting a new architectural aesthetic at the upper level of the speculative market. In contrast to the jumbled appearance of a street of towering timber frame houses dominated by projecting jetties and gables of uneven heights and widths, the length and regularity of the row's facade created some type of architectural unity that could be consciously exploited in a dramatic way. So in the early 1630s, Ingo Jones produced a new classical grammar into urban building in the ranges of houses he designed in Covent Garden for the Earl of Bedford's estate. The facade of these houses was treated as a temple front with a plinth or base corresponding to the ground floor, above which was a giant order of Doric pilasters that rose two stories. The wall, punctuated by windows of diminishing size, at the apex a wooden cornice and dormered roof that ran lengthwise along the street front. The continuous roof range ran parallel to the street rather than being divided into a series of perpendicular gables. The unbroken continuation of the horizontal elements across the facade of the several houses created a bold, unified image. The rusticated ground floor arcade and cornice more than counterbalanced the vertical division of the long facades. What mattered was not the individual units, but the entire range as it stretched in repetition across one side of a piazza and around another. So this was entirely novel in English building, and was not repeated with the same essence in subsequent developments. The Italian-inspired arcades, for example, took up too much precious ground space to be a success in a more modest undertaking. Yet later builders appreciated the square's coherence, the temple-fronted division of the facade, and its classically inspired detailing, symmetry, and uniformity of parts. At the heart of this recasting of the facades in classical terms was the formula of proportioning and repetition of the constituent parts. Whether four stories or two units or a range stretching of an entire block, the pattern could be modulated and repeated according to the size of the project. Builders began to apply these rules to other developments, some of which approached the ambitious scale of Covent Garden, while others remained more modest speculations. Houses constructed in Lincoln's Inn Fields and Great Queen Street in the late 1630s and early 1640s dispensed with the arcades of Covent Garden, but followed the repetition of elements across the entire length of the rows to create rhythmic harmonies. Each bay of these and other houses built in the following decades was articulated by two-story pilasters that rose above the ground floor plinth. The red brick walls were crowned at the eaves with a deep wooden cornice and dormered roofs that ran the lengthwise along the street front. Praised for the uniform and regular appearance, the great Queen Street buildings led one early 18th century critic to describe them as a row of houses that Italy itself would not be ashamed of. Architectural historian John Summerson argued that the influence of these houses was such that they laid down the canon of street design, which put an end to gabled individualism and provided a discipline for London streets, which was accepted for more than 200 years after that. Whether pedestal or common or articulated as pilasters, attached columns, or in a portico form, does not affect the principle. It is a question merely of proportion and modulation. So before the Great Fire in London in 1666, the uniform row with its classically inspired facade, capped by a low or flat roof, was extraordinarily rare. The great estates of the West End were only beginning to develop based on a reinterpretation of Jones' work at Covent Gardens and subsequent designs in Great Queen Street and Lincoln's Inn Fields. The full effect of these rules on row building was not evident for many years, as builders accepted some aspects of the new style while retaining older forms. They were giving a significant boost with the passage of the Act for the rebuilding of the City of London in 1667, following the Great Fire, which stipulated that the new houses were built to be divided into four classes according to size and location, for better regulation, uniformity, and gracefulness. Although the Act codified many of the principles evident in the Great Queen Street and Lincoln's Inn Field developments, its immediate impact on buildings in London and outside the capital was slightly and only slowly starting to dislodge a style of building that had flourished for nearly half a century. Recent scholarship has described a much more complex interplay between traditional practices with a new innovative design that Summerson acknowledged. Throughout England, bricklayers and other craftsmen rarely emulated the schemes of Jones, Webbs, and others, or who promoted in architectural treatise by Renaissance scholars, but freely adopted much of their classical detailing to produce richly textured facades, festooned and carved with molded brickwork and accented by pedimented apertures and gables, in an exuberant style that Summerson christened artisan mannerism. So the subsequent rebuilding of many town centers has erased much of the evidence of this artisan manner style, which now survives only in isolated examples in England. The London suburbs escaped the Great Fire, and a few still retain vestiges of mid-17th century housing. Rising above the city, the outlying northern suburb of Islington witnessed increased speculative development that changed its complexion as short rows displaced by longer houses from the middle decades of the century onward. So this process can be seen at Newington Green, which has a range of four brick dwellings erected by one or perhaps two speculators in 1658. The designer of these three-story row followed the fashion exemplified by the great Queen Street facades, defining the bays by ordered pilasters rising above the ground floor plinth. At the eaves level, the entablature breaks out over the pilasters, which, though not strictly correct according to classical rules, does follow a precedent set by Ingo Jones in the Banqueting House in Whitehall. However, standing above the entablature are four gabled facades facing the street, which harken back to an earlier period of pre-classical urban design. Some, if not all, of these houses originally had heated garrets, which were lit by a window in the front, and rear parapeted gables. On the front elevation, these windows do not line up evenly with the windows below, nor are they centered over the pilasters. Throughout London and across the country, there were probably far more ranges of buildings that followed the Newington Green example of mixing traditional with classical design elements than those of those who have strictly adhered to the classical composition exhibited in Great Queen Street, in Lincoln's Inn Fields, and subsequent West End estates. So with or without pilasters, many rows continued the customary pattern of constructing gable roofs perpendicular to the street, often combining many influences with other or more robust elements. These northern European predilections were shaped gables became absorbed in many parts of the country, with the native fondness for spirited brickwork producing distinctive styles of rows, almshouses, and individual dwellings. So typical of the artisan manor style in the southeast was a brick row of three houses that once stood on High Street in Sandwich and was capped by three curvy linear gables. Shaped gables must have been a common sight in London, though the very end of that century. But one such example, which survived until the early 20th century, was built at the corner of Stewart and Forest Street in Spitalfields in the 1680s. The temple front, crowned by a gable or hip roof, must have been an integral part of the Craftsman Designs program through the end of the century. It was promoted as a standard form after the London Fire in such publications as Joseph Moxon's Mechanic Exercises. Moxon offered his readers an example of a three-story, three-bay brick townhouse that could have been built as part of a row. Regularly spaced apertures with molded flat arches punctuate the facade, with each story separated by a plant band. Above the cornice is a gable roof facing the street. Moxon's design can be found in numerous mid to late 17th century brick and timber frame buildings in the metropolis and much of the country. A pair of late 17th century timber frame houses, say at 38 and 37, Upper Street in Islington, has hipped roofs facing the street. Canterbury is filled with a number of more modest gable end rows of this period. So the homes at 73 through 76th Street in Dunstan are part of timber frame row of four units with projecting jettied gables. At 72 and 74 Broad Street, the first two stories of a three-story unit row are faced with brick, with a 1693 date brick just below the plant band. Above the second story, the timber frame gable end garrets project beyond the brick facade. This older tradition flourished in cities outside of London. Three houses in an original row of five survive at 3 to 5 King Street in Bristol. Built in about 1664, the facades are enlivened by the bay window, jetties, and street-facing gables. Such types continue well into the 18th century, before flatter roofs that ran parallel to the street displaced them. Closer to London, a brick pair, 106 through 108, Blackheath Hill in Greenwich, which probably date to no earlier than 1740, must have appeared entirely old-fashioned when they were constructed. It was during this time that the older roof forms were often modified or hidden by brick parapets or by some construction or other detail. So despite the efforts, town views of Oxford, Bath, and other cities in the early 18th century were still dominated by streets lined with gable-fronted buildings. Before the London Fire, the uniform row with a classically inspired facade capped by a low or flat roof was extraordinarily rare. The great estates of the West End were only beginning to develop based on a reinterpretation of Jones' work at Covent Garden, and the subsequent designs of the great on Queen Street and Lincoln's Inn Fields. So perhaps far more common were the rows that integrated traditional gable-fronted forms with classical elements, expressed in the artist mannerism of New York or New England's craft builder, and evident in small-scale speculations such as 52 to 55. Newington Green in Islington, at the lowest end of the scale, timber and brick rows simply adorned with gable and hip roofs facing the street, appeared in rapidly growing industrial towns and seaports to house a workforce of laborers, tradesmen, and shopkeepers. Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing out. That is section or part two of the English origins of Jamestown's row houses. Thanks for listening.